It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
Oh, welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky. We're coming to you recording live to the increasingly unuseful metaphor of tape.
On Thursday. Live to a series of tubes.
Live to the cloud, I guess, maybe. On Thursday, June 24th. We're going to do half the show, kind of a normal show of talking about what's going on in the world. And then the back half of the show, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about Crying in H-Mart by Michelle Zauner, which came out. And I think it's having a bit of a moment. It's going to be made into a TV show and other things going on. So a prescient time to talk about that. Rebecca, how are you?
I'm good. We're having a little summer, like not quite cold snap, but it was cooler than 60 degrees when I woke up this morning in Virginia, nice. Which is lovely. And it has been a nice week. I am reading a digital galley of the new oral biography of Anthony Bourdain that his longtime assistant, Lori Wolliver, put together, which when you mentioned world travel or world traveler, I can't remember what the title is of the world travel book. World travel. When we were doing our, you know, sort of honorable mentions for faves of the year so far, it reminded me that this was coming out and that I had seen it on Edelweiss. So I, you know, clicked a few buttons and made my way there. And it is wonderful.
Oh, good.
She interviewed like 100 people from across Bourdain's life, like folks who were friends of his when he was a kid, folks who worked with him in restaurants before he got famous, his first wife, Nancy, his second wife, Otavia, his mother, his brother, like all sorts of folks. Eric Repair is in there, and it moves up from around like late high school age all the way through his career. And I am just where he's like really starting to get super famous. And I love an oral history. I've never read an oral history of a person, an oral biography like this. That's
right. Weird.
Like, have you seen anything like that?
Well, I guess what do we talk about when we talk about oral histories, right? I mean, the form as we know them goes back to, you know, WPA administration days of talking to, I think it was like ex-slaves, black sharecroppers, of going around and Alan Lomax recording. I think this is where, so something beyond a historian's biography and just talking to folks. I think this is, again, I could be wrong about this. I'll try to make some notes for next time. So the oral history being you're just listening and recording to people talking. You're not doing interviews. You're not doing archival work. It's just that. So of a person, no. Is your memory of like the oral history as an internet thing is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it often covers subjects that don't merit probably a full book, like an oral history of this one episode of The West Wing or this one
exactly.
kind of like C-list movie.
Right, an oral that people history still have an affection for. Records, yeah.
Great example, yeah. But as a person, I don't know, no.
And, you know, usually I guess it's because either there's a lot of historical records about the person if you're just going to go straight biography, or maybe they've written an autobiography and there's a lot of, you know, personal stuff that's on the page and that's already available to people. But, you know, Wolliver doesn't write, at least not in the galley version, any sort of deep intro about how she arrived at doing this book or using this format. But it's a way of constructing Bourdain's life told through the people who were closest to him at various points. And I am finding it to be what I was hoping it would be. And it is that sort of classic oral history setup where it's like, here's a paragraph of his mother talking. And as she's tapering off, his brother, who, you know, either was also in the room or who had also discussed the same topic, like his quote comes in and it just moves between them. And there's no narrative thread provided by Wolliver from the outside. But she's done a lovely job putting things in order and telling the story. And I was like, it's just a fascinating way to learn about a person that so many of us were fascinated by. And we got to see Bourdain as he presented himself, but seeing him now through the lens. And it's, you know, varied and contains multitudes, as all of us do. But seeing him through the lens of those people and folks talking about, here's a way that he was different than what you would see on TV, or here's what's surprising, or like, here was a time that he was kind of a jerk to me. Like, it's a very human and I think robust portrait of a person. And I'm like fascinated by it. It's made me think about who else would I want this kind of biography of? And to me, it is more interesting and engaging as a reader than a straight, you know, historically researched biography would be. So I'm deep in that land right now. I'm just thinking about how much I liked Tony Bourdain.
It's a different kind of work, right, than sort of the Robert Cairo, I mean, certainly mm-hmm. than the Robert Cairo version, but even something like even a sports journalist writing a book about the 96 Bulls, as opposed to the Michael Jordan Bulls documentary, which is essentially an oral history, right? That we were, that was one of our pandemic faves. I think we'll have pandemic phase memories, which was essentially organizing interviews. That's an oral biography of the Bulls. There wasn't much interstitial, if any interstitial sort of investigative reporting. They had all this footage and they had access to all these people. Let Scottie Pippen cook for a few minutes about how mad he was about not, you know, like do that kind of stuff. So yeah. I think it has its place. Certainly, I think it's probably more entertaining than a more straight history. It's probably a lot less work, so you can turn something around. I'm not saying it's not a lot of work, but it's different than, you know, Bourdain's junior high transcripts, and here's an interview with his therapist, and here's his contract, and you know, it's different. So I think it's from a reader's point of view. And for someone like Tony Bourdain and our particular fandom, for lack of a better term of it, it is a lot of the document one. And I was thinking about it in terms of, did you watch the Friends reunion thing on HBO?
I did. Yeah. Did you?
I did. And I found myself, I just want to let them tell stories about, I don't need the fashion show and the game or whatever. The thing I want is the people who were there. I want the primary sources. They're alive. I mean, that's the other thing about history is sometimes you can't do an oral biography because people dead. But in this case, what else do you want, especially when it's personality driven? I think that's the thing you're kind of onto with Bourdain. Because like Toni, for example, we know her personality a little bit, but if given a choice between a Toni Morrison oral biography and, say, you know, a more conventional literary biography, I would like both, but if I had to pick one, I want the totemic work that stands as a reference. But if I'm talking about George Clooney, you know, kind of a personality, someone I like in the world, Michael B. Jordan, you know, Zendaya. Do I need I don't need the 800-page thing, but you like the personality, you like the person, and the person themselves is entertaining and interesting. Bourdain's a raconteur. He does wild stuff. So probably an oral history of Robert Cairo is not what you want, but a history of Robert Cairo is probably more interesting. I don't know. I just
somebody
find it,
might I want that. I just don't. I think the documentary TV example is incredibly helpful in my sorting out how I'm thinking about this and responding to it, because it does, the experience of reading this does feel very similar to seeing Michael Jordan talking about himself, but also then seeing Scottie Pippen talk about it, and then seeing their coaches talk about it, and then seeing like one of his relatives talk about things. And I can imagine that this could have been a similar kind of documentary project where it's all these folks sitting in their living rooms sharing their memories of Bourdain rather than it ending up in print. And that's exactly what it feels like in the reading of it, that it's super interesting to get all these different perspectives. And, you know, you get like his brother sort of talking smack about like their mom and some of the ways that Anthony Bourdain interacted with their mom, or like long-running conflicts, and then a page later there's their mom talking about that same thing but not knowing that it was a thing that drove him crazy. Like, she was a longtime copy editor for the New York Times and, you know, spoke fluent French, and apparently once called Bourdain's publisher to correct some like grammatical mistakes in one of his books.
It reminds me of that scene in the Jordan documentary of some, I think it was Gary Payton saying he could guard Jordan, but they had that on an iPad and they gave it to Jordan. Like, I want that. I want that move. You know? I want something like that in the book form.
But Since we had mentioned, you know, you had mentioned world travel last week, and we've talked a lot about our shared appreciation for Bourdain's work on this show, I wanted to toss that out. The book doesn't come out until September, so I'm sorry for mentioning it this far in advance. But if you are also a Tony Bourdain fan, I would sincerely recommend, you know, pre-ordering or requesting your library copy of Bourdain, An Oral Biography by Laurie Wolliver. It's wonderful.
I don't want to tell people how to do their job, but here we go. I don't know. I'm assuming a lot of this was probably email correspondence. I don't know. Like, are these transcribed interviews, whatever? But we have the technology now. Get people on the phone, record it. Your audiobook's ready to go. You're just splicing it together. That's the document you want. The text is fine, but the actual audio of these people saying the words would be awesome.
Reads very conversationally, so I suspect these are actual conversations that she had.
Or a mix, I guess, is possible.
Right, yeah. But I wonder what the audiobook is. I will have to check. Because if it is the spliced together audio, that would be fascinating.
And if it's not, it should be. So
absolutely.
We did a little more on that than we thought, but that's fine. But we do need to take a sponsor break before getting into the rest.
It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
Thought we would check in on sales for some of our summer preview draft picks. I should say, this is not a stacked deck. I did not select this because it would somehow vindicate my unjust loss in the summer.
That was going to be my first question.
Well, the thing that struck me actually dings my basket show title more than anything, and that's what got me thinking about it. So I'm just going to run through some of our picks that are appearing on the list. Now, not everything is out yet because we're doing the full summer. And then some things that did appear, I'm looking in Publishers Weekly, and they only give you the top 20 in the major categories for us. So it's going to be limited, but I think it's still illustrative of what we're doing here. So right now, on the hardcover front list fiction list, which a lot of ours, that would be where they would go, the number one ranked book of our list is number 7 overall, and it was number 6 last week. I'm sorry, pardon me, I got that wrong. It's number 5 this week. And it was number 2 last week, and I believe it debuted last week. And it's Malibu Rising, Taylor Jenkins Reid debut novel. What a showing for her first book. I think that's a wonderful effort.
I mean, it's a really incredible way to debut.
with 15,844 copies. Again, this is BookScan, and we do not have time to do an hour on what BookScan is or isn't, but we'll use it as indicative now. The top 4, Clinton Patterson, Ewan Hildenbrand, John Grisham, and Laura Dave. Laura Dave, the last thing he told me was an Amazon Book Club pick, thriller.
Oh.
So that's showing a little muscle there.
I'm hearing podcast ads for it on like random shows I listen to. Yep. They're doing some marketing for that one.
Disclosure, I think we did some ads of our own.
Oh,
ours
okay,
being
cool.
The wider Book Riot family. Do you want to hear all of the top 20 or just the ones, or are there notable ones? What are you interested in here, Rebecca? Now that
I want to hear the ones that are from our draft.
Okay, so we'll go through, and I'll throw in a couple of interesting ones along the way. The next on our list on the hardcover front list fiction, that's not how you say that word, though it feels like that maybe should be a word for various things. Project Hail Mary, Andy Weir. Number 9 overall, number 7 last week. And again, we're several weeks after. You know, that's the hard thing to gauge about these is some of these things have been out for a while. So the longer it's been since they've released and the higher up the ranking they go, that's a bigger sign of strength, right? That you've been out for a while and still doing here. So that one's pretty interesting, 10,929 copies. This wasn't on our... I don't think we picked this. I can't remember.
We
picked that. I'm sorry. The next one. The Four Winds by Kristen Hannah. Did one of us pick this, or was that before? It was out before June, I think. Number 10 last week. Number 9. Remember, a million hard copy print run, I don't know enough about the shape of these things over time, but at first blush, do I expect it to be doing better than selling 10,000 copies a week right now if it has a million print run?
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. The other black girl, one we talked about before, we did not pick it for our summer basket. This week, number 12. Last week, number 8.
Okay.
That's it on the top 20 fiction for us. Nonfiction. Did I pick The Bomber Mafia? I can't remember now. I think that was out before Father's Day.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Wait, which is that the Gladwell-esque situation? Maybe you did pick it. You might have.
I might have picked it. I wish I would have. It's number 7.
It's a good
this
thing
week.
We keep such detailed records.
Yeah, I know.
Here.
People can remind us. It's more interesting than anything else. Nothing else. Though notably, right. World Travels, number 14, Crying in H Mart 15, Cast. Isabel Wilkerson, still in hardcover, still racking up sales. Glad
good
to see that.
Good for her. I just reread that because I had a deep sense that I didn't possibly absorb everything I wanted to from when I read it in 2020. Yeah, I just reread it like last month. And whew, that's, folks, if you think about the kinds of things that we think about on this show and the kinds of stuff that Book Riot cares about, and you're thinking about how to better understand race and what we're dealing with, like Cast, I think is so essential.
I want to shout out a couple of things that we've talked about before. They didn't make it into either of our picks for last year or Books of the Year or anything else like that, but they continue to sell. Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which is a September 2020 release, V.E. Schwab, number 15 on hardcover, front list fiction. And then The Invisible Library, talk about a stayer. That is, or The Midnight Library, Library, that's Matt Haig. That also came out last year. That's number 7 on front list fiction. And that book has like 70,000 reviews on Amazon.
Yeah. Look, if you put library in the title and the book is kind of magical, you're going to do fine. And by all accounts,
but
this
there's
one
so
is well
many. I feel like there's so many. I don't know. Maybe it's the exception that proves the rule. I don't know. You might be right.
It's not like a pass to the bestsellers list, but I do think it's an automatic leg up.
Yeah. You know, here's another one I found interesting, and we haven't talked about John Green in a while, but his new book is called The Anthropocene Reviewed. It's a nonfiction title, and I think it's vignette-y kind of chapters around, you know, human things, and all of them are signed right now. All the first editions are signed, which is a wild undertaking. 7,000 copies sold last week, number 12, number 6 last week. Feels like the John Green thing in popular mainstream book culture, for whatever reason, isn't what it was. Right after, I guess, that time between Fault in Our Stars being published and the movie coming out, felt like the apex of John Green as a cultural voice. Seems to have been supplanted. I don't know by what, but is not on the firmament like it once was.
Interesting. I think it's a product of like where we are in generational shifts in media, like in the media landscape. I was thinking about this last week, that which is maybe the first time I've thought about John Green in like 5 years. But I think many of his fans are sort of the younger millennials and older like Gen Z crowd, and he's sort of, you know, we're all aging, but like those fans are aging out of the like spinning central core of what what defines cool, what's cool and what everybody's into on the internet. Like, I'm certainly aged out of it, so are you, so it's not like we're casting judgment on on that being a thing that happens, but I think that it's a product of that. It's hard to stay relevant when so much interest is driven by the internet and social media and by the younger generations of folks in those spaces. And I think John Green's fans are staying with him and are aging up with him, but I don't know that he's getting, and I could be completely wrong about this. I have not gone like down a YouTube thing to see what the subscribership patterns to his vlogs have been or anything like that. But my best guess is that that is what's happening, that it's not like new kids coming up onto the internet or finding their way to John Green now. They're finding their way to somebody else.
And I think that's just true of most, if not all, popular culture, right? Like Pearl Jam isn't the 14-year-old me's band anymore. It's the 43-year-old me's band. Nothing wrong with that. It's just that if you make hay in the spring, it's hard to keep it all the way into the summer and fall of people's lives as they go on.
Totally. Yeah. I listened to a 2-hour podcast about counting crows last week, but I don't think there are 22-year-olds doing that right now.
Yeah. Not sure there are that many 30-year-olds doing that right now. No shade in the Everglades. Mark.
No shade.
Trade paperback front list, number one overall. Where the Crawdads Sing by one Daily Owens ever heard of it. 20,000 units.
Throw a party the day that comes off the list.
Freed, E.L. James, number two. Still interestingly, publishing directly to paperback. Famously, I don't know my history of front list paperback releases, new releases. But that was an interesting one, and they've continued. Even though they could probably sell in hardcover for $27.99 at this point, they've chosen not to.
Yeah, and there's that confounding thing of that romance doesn't usually out in hardcover, but they're doing some hardcovers now for some of the like crossover publications. But yeah, I mean, I think they totally could sell some $27 copies of E.L. James, but they're probably doing more volume right at the start because it's paperback.
And the last one that was in our baskets, One Last Dot by Casey McQuiston, again, on that romance paperback kind of established prior. Number 8 overall, down from number 2 last week, which I think was its debut week. Can't remember now. 10,662 copies. Interestingly, Casey McQuiston right now is selling as many copies per week as Kristen Hanna is, just give you some context for the four wins. Again, paperback hasn't been out quite as long. But I think that's a good showing from McQuiston.
That's great.
Notable absences on things that we had, you know, we had some print run information for. Somebody's Daughter was on the chart last week for its debut. It fell off the hardcover front list nonfiction. Saw some chatter about a few TikTok viral hits in the literary fiction world. One is, interestingly, Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. Apparently, there's a crying on TikTok over a book gets other people to pick. No, it's a thing.
I think like a month ago, I put a link into our agenda that was like the kids are crying on TikTok, right. And we didn't get to it. But yes,
But it is interesting that so that would be a paperback backlist, right? And that's not covered here. Mm-hmm. You could go find it if you had a BookScan account. But I think as social media and as these backlist long tails get even longer, there's more chance for something to bubble up organically like that. I really like a backlist. Now, again, it could be all Dale Carnegie. And Da Vinci Codes. I'm not sure how you would do it, but could we get like, I don't know, is there another way to capture that data? Well, I think there's an Aileen Kofor book or E.K. Johnson. I can't remember that also kind of have been making their rounds on there. So that's, I thought those were notable. I don't think there's anything, because our number one, two, I think all of our kind of top picks were in there. Can you think of anything that we were high on in terms of sales that we haven't talked about that didn't
well the
make
Daniel
it here.
Henderson just came out this week, I think. Yeah. So
hard to know. People, I think that's Ashley Ford and Daniel Henderson have a problem in this, and we talked about this on the show. It's like people don't know who those people are outside of the world of books, really. And so these are the most mainstream. Not that they couldn't have a cross, this happens from time to time. I think Crying in H Mart actually is a good example. It's been out for a little while, and we can talk about why that might be.
True.
I think in a lot of ways, it has a lot of the same underlying DNA as something like Somebody's Daughter, but maybe we'll talk about that when we get to it.
Yeah, and I wonder about Somebody's Daughter falling off the bestseller list might be a product of having had a really big pre-order campaign or a very successful pre-order campaign, that pre-orders get counted on the day that the book comes out. They're included in the first week of release for the bestseller list. And from what I've seen, I follow Ashley on Instagram. I follow a lot of folks who were talking about how excited they were for the book to come out. I think there was I'm pretty confident that there were a lot of copies of that book pre-ordered that would have contributed to bestseller list the week of release and to hanging out there. And yeah, I think it's challenging. Danielle Henderson has been doing all kinds of interesting work, but her name is much less known. And most recently, she's been working in TV and is in writer. I think she is a showrunner currently for a show that she's working on. So much less well known, but I did see, because I follow Elizabeth Gilbert as well, and she does like a monthly book club thing on Instagram, that Elizabeth Gilbert's current book club selection is The Ugly Cry by Danielle Henderson. So at some point, I'm actually going to watch an entire Instagram live.
Wow, we're really getting younger here as we sit on the podcast. Well, I mean,
she says right, at 2 o'clock right, on a yeah. Thursday
we'll
afternoon.
Check out that with the yeah. 6 years. See how we did. I guess the only other pre-orders, it's always unknown. Which books have more or less pre-orders, I think, is not something is generally known unless you are looking at BookScan and as working for an imprint, right? Like what percentage of sales? Because the counter to that would be Oprah's selection of Somebody's Daughter, of course, comes after its publication date. So there could be another weight on the other side of the scale. Like I said, I think the book's really good. I was surprised it had the print run it did. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like, I don't want to suggest it's underperforming or something like that relative to my expectation of it. Probably something that'll have heat over time and it become part of Ashley's backlist as she continues to write and publish and other things like that. So I'm not giving up the ghost on
that
one.
I think that one's
in particular.
I think that that's a memoir we're going to talk about for a long time as being representative of a kind of, I hope, paradigm shift in the ways that personal stories like that get told. I can totally see it being taught in like MFA.
The other
strange new
arrival on the scene in these charts, which I've been looking at, you know, I've been subscribed to Publishers Weekly really since we started the show a little bit before, in the trade paperback frontlist section, manga. We've got 6 out of the top 20 trade paperback frontlist books are manga titles, which 5 years ago, you maybe would see a graphic novel from time to time, maybe a new volume of, I don't even think, you know, Paper Girls or something. Like, I'm trying to think of what the most popular ones were even 5 years ago. Lumberjanes, a new Lumberjanes or something would make it from time to time. Saga. Yeah, another good one. Again, those were volumes. But we've seen on the site, the manga attention is way different than it used to be. Be interesting to see how long it lasts. Would you like to hear the number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 children's frontlist fictions? Dave Pilkey, Kenny, Pilkey, Pilkey, Kenny. Unbelievable stuff.
Okay.
Six of Crows, Bardugo, number 22. Mm-hmm. And then Rule of Wolves, number 20, Bardugo. I think it's interesting.
Oh, wow.
I guess those are front list. I'd love to know how those are selling compared to Shadow and Bone. The only reason is Shadow and Bone, I would have to imagine, it's outselling Six of Crows right now. But because we don't have a front list or a backlist fiction list, we don't. Well, yeah. unless you know, you know.
Well, and we also don't really know how much a Netflix series drives book sales, except in cases where the book was previously not really selling at all, and like The Witcher, right. And then it became a big thing. So I don't know. Like, I really don't have a sense of, has everybody who's going to read Shadow and Bone read it and now they're just watching it on Netflix? Or like, are there folks watching on Netflix who aren't going to pick up the book? Is it not really moving the dial in that respect? I have no idea. I also haven't read any of the Bardugos, so I can't weigh in on, you know, what I think.
Six of Crows and Rule of Wolves are better than the problem with, well, the problem. Bardugo's doing fine. The first Shadow and Bone book is the weakest of all the five because there's the trilogy and the duology, and there's some other stuff that I haven't got to.
Wait,
well,
five
these are
of
parallel.
Them?
Oh, they're, yeah, par- they're parallel. Six of, anyway, it doesn't. In the show, mixes them up. It's kind of a. I understand why they didn't. I think it's ultimately successful. But Shadow and Bone is not where I'd have people start. If you want to start the Bardugo train, even related to or not related to the show, start with Six of Crows. I think that's the best read, the best point of entry. Eric Carle, number 3 on children's picture books. Very Hungry Caterpillar, Very Hungry Caterpillar. Number 4, Brown Bear, Brown Bear, What Do You See with Martin and Carle. And then number 11.
There.
Oh, number 10, I Love Dad with the Very Hungry Caterpillar. That's some seasonal Father's Day pandering marketing.
Is those the places you'll go
number one,
still on,
still
or have
number
we crossed
one,
out
number
of graduation?
One, 25. It's, okay, it's 10K. Right. It's almost 50% more than the next book, which is The Bench, which is The Duchess of Sussex. Oh, that's English royalty stuff. I don't know what that is.
Oh,
I mean, I know
yes.
what it is. I know enough not to know.
Oh, it's the new, yeah, it's the new book by Meghan Markle that apparently does like reimagine fatherhood.
She's the Duchess of Sussex, and that's what she goes by.
That seems like a marketing mistake.
She lives in America now.
It is. I can confirm it's Meghan Markle's new book.
Weirdly, for children's picture books, there's no front list, there's no back list. It is all one under the grand unified theory of how children's books sell. So we get weird artifacts of like really knowing nothing about what's new and just what people are nostalgic for. So there's our little trip through midsummer book sales.
All right. Well, what I've mainly taken away from this is that I was really right about Malibu Rising, the debut novel from Taylor Jenkins Reid.
Unbelievable. I'm really looking forward to her next two or three novels. I wonder something about a band, you know? Something about a band? Or
oh, maybe in the 70s.
Be good on audio, like probably.
A little, you know, an oral history, maybe.
Taylor Jenkins Reid's future books. Let's do another sponsor. Let's do a few news stories. All right, we went longer on that. So pick one. One new story, Rebecca. What's the biggest one of the week that you want to talk about?
Oh, I mean, we have to do our story right. We don't want to talk about, but that we have to talk about, which is that parents in the Lehigh Valley School District of Pennsylvania are suing over lessons being taught about Black Lives Matter. This is part and parcel with the panic we're seeing from conservatives with the broad misuse of the term critical race theory. And I'll include a link to a great Vox explainer if you're like, why are we talking about critical race theory? Because isn't that a thing from law school? It is, in fact, a thing from the world of law and legal studies, and the right has co-opted it. But kind of part and parcel of this, Maureen and Christopher Brophy are parents from this school, and they are saying in their lawsuit that topics discussed in their children's classrooms, such as systemic racism, white fragility, religion, white privilege, Black Lives Matter, and police brutality, are unacceptable and will not be tolerated. They claim that those topics are anti-Christian and that they discriminate against their religion. They filed suit this Monday in federal court. And the East Penn School District solicitor responded by saying, anybody can file a lawsuit by paying the filing fee. Being successful is something completely different. So that's it. May your efforts succeed.
We'll take your fee. Right?
Yes. And so this started when their 16-year-old son and 15-year-old daughter were assigned to read White Fragility at school last year in 2020. The parents requested to exempt their children from those topics, and their request was denied. So also, like, mad props to whoever in the Lehigh School District was like, no, actually, we think your children should maybe learn about racism. And the lawsuit maintains that the topics do not coincide with the family's moral compass or conservative religious views, and says that they were left, quote, degraded, victimized, embarrassed, and emotionally distressed by the decision that these things should be taught and that they feel that they are anti-Christian. We're going to see this stuff. We keep seeing this stuff, but I understand where the panic is coming from. I understand why this critical race theory branding that the right is doing is, you know, working to catch on. And I would, I don't know, refer the Brophies back to their Bible and maybe what Jesus would have had to say about systemically harming
suing
people.
The school district for your 15 and 16 year old having to read White Fragility is one of the great self-owns in the history of these.
It's great in this case, especially that it's White Fragility.
That's White Fragility. It's on par in irony. And this is not irony. I don't want to say it. It's on par with silliness that's bad, but also kind of pleasure-inducing with the pink dildo lady. Right? It's kind of the same. You're showing what you don't know by doing this thing at all. It's interesting, and this is really one of those cases, too, where there's a cresting wave of interest, I'll put that very neutrally, in critical race theory, especially on the right, as it's trying to make a boogeyman out of something, right? It's trying to make mm-hmm. it's trying to make it almost like communism, an easy buzzword that people can be against. Though asked to define it, I would gather that 96% of the people who are against it couldn't tell you anything about it at all. And in fact, I read one of the seminal texts of critical race theories, or one of the seminal authors. I'm not sure if it's a seminal text because it was an undergraduate book by, I forget the guy's name, Delgado, Edward Delgado, called The Rodrigo Chronicles, which is told as, I think I've talked about it on the show before, maybe when I did my own Reading Lies episode, mm-hmm. is one of the seminal books for me, where it's an older professor in dialogue with a younger student. Both, it's a fictionalized thing. It's like a Socratic dialogue kind of a situation where an older professor of law has a precocious young student. And at one point, you know, kind of the student becomes the teacher about the new wave of thinking about race and the law and systemic racism. I defy people of open mind and good intent not to find it very persuasive. Those are two important caveats, I think, in these situations, right? those with ears to listen, to quote my Bible, I think. It's pretty interesting mm-hmm. and very readable, I should say. And I'm sure there are other texts now that are more updated things. But this is one that I still I don't have a lot of undergraduate reading on my shelf that's not fiction. And this is one, and I will keep it as long as I have a physical bookshelf. So it's a high. I'm recommending a book as part of this. This is the only antidote to this sort of garbage that's out there.
Yes. You know, it's this being their response to white fragility being assigned is the book ban or book complaint version of, like, that the first comment on the internet on any piece about racism or sexism yes, proves that's right. why we need to have pieces about racism and sexism. And it seems like this family are widely aggrieved. They've complained about a teacher's personal social media posts that they felt were offensive and anti-Christian. The school district defended that teacher, saying that they, you know, are allowed to speak on matters of public concern in their private lives mm-hmm. as long as those statements aren't knowingly false or recklessly made. They've also made some complaints about school conditions and online learning conditions during COVID of the last year. So there's a lot going on here. But, you know, our public schools have a duty to teach our children about the history of this country. And this country was undeniably built on stolen labor from Black people. And that doesn't mean that we're teaching every little white child, which I've seen this complaint, like, why are you teaching my children that they are racist and you're going to make them feel bad? And you know what? Like, we should all take a moment as those of us who are white to consider what elements of our upbringings would have better served us if they had taught us earlier on. Examine how this benefits you. Examine what racist ideas you may be holding that you haven't identified yet. And also, this is the system. You are not a bad person, probably, but you're in this system that you are inevitably shaped by. Suing the kids' school district is definitely not doing your kids any favors in their social lives, in their school district either. And
I think they've got something else going on at home, Rebecca. I'm just going to throw that out there. It's not an excuse. It just feels to me
something's
like
going on here. Yeah. But this is a thing. I think we're just going to continue to see more of this now that the buzzword of critical race theory has caught on. And I agree. I would love to see someone say, like, I will entertain your complaint about this when you can define critical race theory for me. Because all I can think about right now, and there was a story in BuzzFeed this morning about, like, parents getting arrested at a public hearing over critical race theory. It just seems like that scene in Field of Dreams where Annie has to yell at, you know, at least I'm not a book burner, you Nazi cow. Like, that, it's devolving into that kind of conversation. And sadly, I think we're just going to see more of this as the, you know, media machine on the right starts moving to try to erase these conversations and the teaching of this history from public schools that have a duty to teach it.
At least the Nazi cow in Field of Dreams did the reading, it sounds like. I think she actually read the Boat Rocker. In all fairness to the Nazi cow, I mean, this is where we are.
Is this our show title? In all fairness to the Nazi cow. No.
But I'm just saying, like, this is so much. This makes that look reasonable. It does. Bad and stupid. But it's like she read the book. She knew it was in it. It's stupid and bad. And I agree with Amy Madigan. But like compared to this, she looks like a scholar.
It's true. Always agree with Amy Madigan.
Okay, let's move to Crying in H Mart. So what we're going to do is let's talk overview, context, and then I'm going to play a little excerpt, and then we'll do spoiler talk for a few minutes in a minute. So how's that order
sound,
Rebecca?
To me.
We haven't really planned this out. Crying in H Mart, why did we pick this book?
We were trying to pick one of the, like, quote unquote, big books of the spring so far, of the year so far. And I think we were both like, well, we've done a lot of fiction this year, and that's been great. But also, it's hard to find other fiction you want to do when you got to talk about Clara and the Sun. And I think this one was your idea. And you were like, "This I'm seeing people talk about this, and it does ring a lot of bells that we share. There's a theme of food running throughout. It's a memoir that deals with complex family relationships and identity. And all of those are hooks that we are happy to hang our hats on. So that's how we arrived at that. Basically, you said, what do you think about Crying in H Mart? I was like, cool, let's do it.
It took my incredible sophist powers really overcame a lot of resistance on that.
I'm such a hard sell most of the time.
I think
time.
It's having a bit of a moment in like the hipster reader section. I mean, Michelle Zauner fronts a well-regarded independent rock band, right? So like, there's an indie rock, independent rock band. Hello, fellow kids. and it had the book started as, and the kernel of the book started as an essay in The New Yorker, which had a moment too. And I think it fits in with a lot of interesting questions and sensibilities that people have. It's also, to me, to look at like the genealogy of our picks to talk about, it's like, cross somebody's daughter with Eat a Peach and you get Crying in H Mart.
Yes. I think that's right.
in a lot of ways. So I think it's worth doing. I think it's very well written. There's a lot of technical stuff I really like. She's best known now as the front woman for Japanese Breakfast, but I don't think that's going to last very long. I think she's a writer, Rebecca Shinsky.
Yeah, I think she's a writer too. It's I'm ready for whatever she writes next. This was absorbing from the get-go.
Yeah, so go ahead. And
I would say it's like, it's so compelling and it's difficult. It does that thing where you're like, this is going to make me cry and I'm going to sit here for 4 hours anyway.
Yeah, so let's do a little pitch for people who may not stick around past the excerpt when we talk about, you know, the substance of it, because I think there's a couple of haymakers here that I don't want to spoil. I think you need to have happen in the course of the book that are meaningful and not just, you know, telling plot points about Indiana Jones 5 or something like that. It's a memoir about her, mostly about her mother's death, frankly, and that as a flashpoint for her to consider her own identity, her own upbringing, and her own history. And the titular Crying in H Mart, it starts in closer to the present after her mother has died, and she is talking about what it's like for her to go into H Mart, which, for those of you who don't know, are these Asian superstore food palace casino things. Not casino terms of gambling, but they're really enormous, impressive food hall, grocery store structures that exist in towns that have large Asian American communities. My understanding is that at its core, it's a Korean chain, but I might be wrong about that. But it incorporates a food from wider, I guess, especially East Asia. It's less Southeast Asia. Indian subcontinent and Pakistan. So really, it's Korea, Japan, China. It sounds like there's some Vietnamese and Cambodian stuff there, but it's a place, especially in America, where people who either are foodies writ large or have family nostalgia for the food of their youth or their parents, or frankly, this is their cuisine and this is the best place for them to get groceries and supplies to make it. And I think this place of displacement as going crying in H Mart is one of the more evocative titles once you've read the book about what it means. Mm-hmm. Like where and when this is happening and over what is super important. And I think it's extremely well read. I think well written. I think the best pieces to me, her description of H Mart as a communal space is wonderful. And that's in the first chapter.
Yes.
And that's the selection I'm going to play here in a minute. And then bridges out, and the way that she details, I think, Zauner's attention to, catalog of, and care in detail, whether it's the food, the ingredients, her mother's beauty regimen, her mother's her mother's diagnosed with cancer and dies young, her specificity and thoroughness around her symptoms and care and medication is also, but her attention to the detail, the specific, is a thing I think sets it apart from a lot of memoirs, right? It really grounds it. Now, I think there are some secondary effects of that that I'm going to save for after the excerpt. It's not very long, 231 pages. It reads very quickly. It is very sad. Very, very sad. There's trigger warnings here for some abuse. There's something else I had. There's a scene of violence where her boyfriend, now husband, is violently attacked. That's pretty gnarly. Any other trigger warnings, Rebecca? It's sadder than it is triggery, I guess, on the whole, for my understanding of it.
There's discussion of addiction. Her father is recovering addict, maybe at times on the page, actively addicted. And we don't get a lot of that, but there are some examples given. So if that's a difficult thing for you to read about or listen to, take that in if you're going to pick up the whole book, for sure.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to do a sponsor break, excerpt her Michelle's description of H Mart. It's not as long as the Somebody's Daughter excerpt. And then Rebecca and I will spend a few minutes talking about the book writ large.
Ever since my mom died, I cry in H Mart. H Mart is a supermarket chain that specializes in Asian food. The H stands for Hanarim, a Korean phrase that roughly translates to one arm full of groceries. H Mart is where parachute kids flock to find the brand of instant noodles that reminds them of home. It's where Korean families buy rice cakes to make tteokguk, the beef and rice cake soup that brings in the new year. It's the only place where you can find a giant vat of peeled garlic, because it's the only place that truly understands how much garlic you'll need for the kind of food your people eat. H Mart is freedom from the single aisle ethnic section in regular grocery stores. They don't prop Goya beans next to bottles of sriracha here. Instead, you'll likely find me crying by the banchan refrigerators, remembering the taste of my mom's soy sauce eggs and cold radish soup, or in the freezer section, holding a stack of dumpling skins, thinking of all the hours that mom and I spent at the kitchen table folding minced pork and chives into the thin dough. Sobbing near the dry goods, asking myself, am I even Korean anymore if there's no one left to call and ask which brand of seaweed we used to buy? Growing up in America with a Caucasian father and a Korean mother, I relied on my mom for access to our Korean heritage. While she never actually taught me how to cook, Korean people tend to disavow measurements and supply only cryptic instructions along the lines of, add sesame oil until it tastes like mom's. She did raise me with a distinctly Korean appetite. This meant a reverence for good food and a predisposition to emotional eating. We were particular about everything. Kimchi had to be perfectly sour, samgyeopsal perfectly crisped, stews had to be piping hot or they might as well have been inedible. The concept of prepping meals for the week was a ludicrous affront to our lifestyle. We chased our cravings daily. If we wanted the kimchi stew for 3 weeks straight, we relished it until a new craving emerged. We ate in accordance with the seasons and holidays. When spring arrived and the weather turned, we'd bring our camp stove outdoors and fry up strips of fresh pork belly on the deck. On my birthday, we ate miyeokguk, a hearty seaweed soup full of nutrients that women are encouraged to eat postpartum and that Koreans traditionally eat on their birthdays to celebrate their mothers. Food was how my mother expressed her love. No matter how critical or cruel she could seem, constantly pushing me to meet her intractable expectations, I could always feel her affection radiating from the lunches she packed and the meals she prepared for me just the way I liked them. I can hardly speak Korean, but in H Mart it feels like I'm fluent. I fondle the produce and say the words aloud, Chamemelon, Danmuji. I fill my shopping cart with every snack that has glossy packaging, decorated with a familiar cartoon. I think about the time Mom showed me how to fold the little plastic card that came inside bags of jollibong, how to use it as a spoon to shovel caramel puffed rice into my mouth, and how it inevitably fell down my shirt and spread all over the car. I remember the snacks Mom told me she ate when she was a kid, and how I tried to imagine her at my age. I wanted to like all the things she did, to embody her completely. My grief comes in waves and is usually triggered by something arbitrary. I can tell you with a straight face what it was like watching my mom's hair fall out in the bathtub, or about the 5 weeks I spent sleeping in hospitals. But catch me at H Mart when some kid runs up double-fisting plastic sleeves of Bunk Diggy, and I'll just lose it. Those little rice cake frisbees were my childhood, a happier time when Mom was there, and we'd crunch away on the styrofoam-like discs after school, splitting them like packing peanuts that dissolved like sugar on our tongues. I'll cry when I see a Korean grandmother eating seafood noodles in the food court, discarding shrimp heads and mussel shells onto the lid of her daughter's tin rice bowl. Her gray hair frizzy, cheekbones protruding like the tops of two peaches, tattooed eyebrows rusting as the ink fades out. I'll wonder what my mom would have looked like in her 70s, if she'd have wound up with the same perm that every Korean grandma gets, as though it were a part of our race's evolution. I'll imagine our arms linked, her small frame leaning against mine as we take the escalator up to the food court. The two of us in all black, New York style, she'd say, her image of New York still rooted in the era of breakfast at Tiffany's. She would carry the quilted leather Chanel purse that she'd wanted her whole life, instead of the fake ones that she'd bought on the back streets of Itaewon. Her hands and face would be slightly sticky from QVC anti-aging creams. She'd wear some strange high-top sneaker wedges that I'd disagree with. Michelle, in Korea, every celebrity wears this one. She'd pluck the lint off my coat and pick on me. How my shoulders slumped, how I needed new shoes, how I should really start using that argan oil treatment she'd bought me, but we'd be together. If I'm being honest, there's a lot of anger. I'm angry at this old Korean woman I don't know, that she gets to live and my mother does not, like somehow this stranger's survival is at all related to my loss. That someone my mother's age could still have a mother. Why is she here slurping up spicy jjampong noodles and my mom isn't? Other people must feel this way. Life is unfair and sometimes it helps to irrationally blame someone for it. Sometimes my grief feels as though I've been left alone in a room with no doors. Every time I remember that my mother is dead, it feels like I'm colliding with a wall that won't give. There's no escape. Just a hard surface that I keep ramming into over and over, a reminder of the immutable reality that I will never see her again.
All right, Rebecca. I guess the thing that elevates this book for me, there's a critique of this book in me, let's say, that is, I don't know how to put this, that's not dismissive because the pain is real and it's one of those. The cancer memoir is a genre, either by a person or a family member. And been there, done that is too strong. But it's its own thing. And so this is more of a cancer book than I thought it was going to be quite honest with you. I'm not sure. What's your reaction to that? Or how are you surprised or otherwise, characterize it?
It was more of a my mom is dead, my mom was dying book than a foodie exploration or a look at food and culture than I was expecting. And this is what happens sometimes because we both like to go into books pretty blind to reviews of them. It was more of that, but I think that it avoids, for me, it avoids the this is one in the genre of cancer books critique because she does so much with identity, that her mom's death isn't just, this is not just, and I don't mean just dismissively either, but this is not solely a book about my mom died of cancer and it was sad. And there is a way to do that book very well, but she's Korean American. Her mother is the Korean parent and Michelle Zahner is wrestling so much with what to make of her own identity as a Korean person and her connections to Korean culture when her most direct connection disappears or dies. And her mother was the one who cooked and her mother was the one who used food as an expression of love. So how will she maintain her connection to that feeling of eating her mother's food if she can't make the same things that her mother made her or if she never learned because her mother never taught her and because in her mother's way of cooking they don't use recipes, she just pour the water in until it covers up your hand.
That's a great detail.
I agree with what you said earlier that her attention to detail and the details that she chooses really make this book special in a way that would have made it an even harder book to read if it were a straight my mom had cancer memoir with all that detail and without the other peripheral questions, actually really central questions about identity and what she's trying to, I don't want to say achieve, but what she's trying to do in her care for her mother, both for her mom and for herself, because their relationship was so difficult and she has felt like a disappointment mm-hmm. and been overtly told that she was very difficult and disappointing. So it was, I think at one point I was like, so is this just a podcast where we talk about books where people have hard relationships with their moms?
I mean,
moms
what other kind
now?
Of book is there, I guess, at some level? Books and they have hard relationships with your fathers, which this
sons,
is also
man.
A book. And actually, maybe more terrifying, her relationship yeah. with her father. And her one of the revelations of the book is that her father has been having paid affairs for a long time. But there's haymaker shot, and I don't want to mention them all, but like notably her father is not mentioned in the acknowledgments, which shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who reads the book. Mm-hmm. But still, that piece is raw. The stuff about her mom is raw in some of the present tense narration of, you know, the immediate, her pretty sudden sickness. It's a little hard to do time, but she gets sick pretty quick. By the time it finds out that she has, it's a gastrointestinal cancer, there's not as much of the book is actually that, thankfully. Not as many of the pages are devoted to that. A lot of that is sort of talking around the edges of what happened before, what happened after, and then kind of looking at it through fingers till you get, you know, pretty hairy stuff about her mother's physical decline. Mm-hmm. But it is not a chronicle of the first x-ray to the last gasp. It is not that from start to finish. And the things on the periphery I think I'm more interested in, and I don't know, maybe if it didn't have the pathos of the middle, maybe Zauner never writes the book. You know, you don't know. But like, we only get a little bit of her story about becoming a successful front woman, having a successful band. I want that story next. I want her, like, mm-hmm. you know, recording piece as well. And I hope we get subsequent works from that. And I like so much what she was doing about her childhood as a Korean American living out on 5 acres. That's not just in Eugene, Oregon, which is a small college town that's about 2 hours south of here of Portland, but several miles outside of Eugene, right? Really on maybe a literal or physical island growing up, and how she was dealing with that. And the two sides of her personality, or two of the major sides as she frames them, there's sort of the Korean food heritage side and her indie rocker teenage girl side that becomes an indie rocker woman side. And that's her, that's kind of how she frames her story of being mixed race. These are two things and they kind of mm-hmm. go together. And ultimately she fuses them at the end, which I was like, how is the book gonna end? Because her mother dies, they bury her. She takes what I would say is a tough hang trip with her father after the fact. But the ending sequence is her as a successful musician with her American band eating Korean food in Korea with her Korean cousin. If that's not a synthesis, I don't know what is. It feels like a moment of, I have found a way of not stitching together halves, not even calling them halves, but of integrating the various pieces of that makes me. And I don't know if I would, you know, I don't want to second guess, but I wonder if in a future version or a different version, that's enough of a story to ground
the whole
thing.
Think integration is the same word that I was going to use for where the place that she arrives by the end. And I think that she doesn't hang a lantern on it, but the way that it made sense to me here is that she can, because of how her parents are and what the relationships there are, like, I mean, one of the haymakers in the book is her mother telling her that she had an abortion after Michelle was born, like in the middle of a fight, like yelling at her that I had an abortion after you were born because I just like couldn't deal with another kid like you, basically. And it is, it's a like gasp out loud, punch you in the stomach moment of reading. I cannot imagine what it felt like to hear it. And that's one of the, like, the places that she backs off of detail are also yes. really telling. Like, we get, my mother said this to me, and it just lands. And we don't get the description of the emotional experience of that. And the same with that very tough hang trip that she takes with her dad. There's a lot of, here is what happened, and very little, here is how I felt about it. And I think it's very consequential that her mom is out of the picture and her dad is much less involved in her life. We don't really know all the details at the end of the book. By the time that she becomes a successful musician who has, as you said, like been able to integrate both sides of her personality, like the I'm going to play in a band thing is part of originally it's part of this sort of classic response that she has to how strict her parents are and to the kinds of expectations that they put on her. Of like, it's kind of like, F you, I'm going to move far away and I'm going to do exactly the things that you told me you were afraid right. I would do. You know, I'm going to live in a filthy, tiny apartment with cockroaches crawling on the counters and I'm gonna play in a band, you know. And I think that she had the experience, that severing of the relationships with her parents in those ways before those parts of her identity could really be her. Yeah. Before I actually do want to be a musician and this is what I'm doing. It's not just a reaction to my parents, and I do want to feel connected to my culture and to the food of my culture, and it's not just a way to try to, you know, make up something about my relationship with my mom. I thought it was a really interesting contrast to Ashley yeah. Ford's book. And, you know, and if we hadn't just stumbled on reading them in the order that we had read them in, I'm not sure I would have been thinking about it that way. But there's so much, like Ashley does so much unearthing of what those relationships mean and where her parents were coming from and how she's understood it. And there's all this sort of, as we talked about, like therapy adjacent processing that happens on the pages of somebody's daughter. And there's not really any of that happening in Crying in H Mart. There's no like, my parents did this and it was abusive and I recognize it as a product of their own stuff. It's like, my parents did this. This was the way that my mom expressed her love to me. And I don't know if she would even label some of those things as abusive in the way that I certainly read them as being.
Yeah, that. I think, and also maybe a salient detail that exemplifies that observation is a narrated issuing of therapy in the book is in the text mm-hmm. of there's not a lot of interior work happening here. It is all externalized in the food making process. And the caring process, people do not talk to each other in this book. And mm-hmm. Michelle does not talk about not talking like Ashley does, right? In that chapter that we included in that chapter, it's very much about finding alternate forms of communication because language and in my late capitalist 40-year-old dad mode of who I am, is what I consider relationship building, you know, the talking, the how are you feeling, how am I mm-hmm. feeling with this, the when you do this, it makes me feel this way, and this conversation back forth. But not only do they literally speak different languages, like the Konglish that Zauner is most fluent in is also not the thing her mother also knows. It's an intermediary step that where they're trying to figure out some way to communicate and say enough to have a relationship, but they either don't know how or not interested in or don't even know is available that some other kind of relationship is possible out there to say, you know, when you comment on my body, it makes me feel like this. Right. And I don't know if you know, you know, that very kind of basic stuff that you could almost role play. They don't understand where each other are coming from. And I'm not sure that they ever do. Except that at some point they jettison the desire to have, as Michelle calls it, a mommy mom. She jettisons a mm-hmm. desire for her mom to be a mommy mom. And Michelle's mother jettisons her expectation that her daughter is going to be whatever her expectation was going to be. As you said, that moment where she comes to her cockroach-infested apartment, doesn't comment, smiles all the way through,
yeah.
Which is a revelation to Michelle. And there is some sort of laying down of expectation on both sides that isn't part of the text. It just kind of happens. And I don't know how, but is that kind of what you're talking about, I guess, in those moments?
Yeah, yeah. That there's also an alternate version of this book as there was for Somebody's Daughter, where she's like, here's what my parents did to me and why I don't talk to them right. anymore. But that's not the book. It's here is the story. And also, I've struggled so much to maintain these relationships and to try to make sense of them and to make sense of myself. And it is all, everything is unspoken. Yeah. nothing is processed out loud, but they do, you know, she understands what her mother is, that her mother is trying to express love when she, you know, tells her the exact right way to eat a particular thing. When some of us, like I'll speak for myself, would experience that as being, you know, very micromanaging. Yes.
Yeah. It's not, it's but she's able to care rather than like, I don't love, that's not love to me. It's interest, care. There's a lot, she does a lot of nice writing. I should have written this down. Maybe you marked it of trying to describe that, like, My mother was more interested in me than anything else in the world, right? And that's different than love, and, as at least we understand.
Yeah, and there's a, I don't remember what the things were in the passage, but I did make a note that her mom expresses her care by paying attention to really subtle things that Michelle likes and enjoys. And it'll be like, you know, your favorite snack is always in the fridge, or that kind of thing. So she knows that her mom is paying attention to who she is and to the things that she likes and enjoys. And there are also all these painful things that happen in their relationship, but she sees some evidence that her mother cares for her. And she's trying to find a way into that relationship, or to, I think the way that you phrased it, at some point they decide to lay things down, even though they don't have any conversation about it, but somehow privately they've gone off to their separate corners and each has decided, how can I be in this space in a way that feels better? And they're sort of struggling through it, stumbling through it. But I found that to be, I think it's really realistic, and that this happens very often, that the relationships in families create pain and create discomfort. And we often arrive at the space of like, well, I can change my response and hopefully that will shift something here. Maybe I'll just be different in this moment and we won't have to talk about it. Which is, I don't think, is a complete, it doesn't lead to complete healing. You know, you don't like finish the cycle of working through the thing, but it does go a way towards having fewer painful interactions. And that, those little moments were the answers to the question that the book poses, like, but why? Like, your mother is horrible to you in these other ways. Your father is horrible to you in these other ways. Why would you care so much? Why are you giving so much up for them? And then she answers that question with those tiny moments.
Yeah, I recommend it. I think it's it can be made to a movie, which I thought of. It's always hard when you know something's going to be made into a movie or maybe a limited series. I don't know, to be what the highlights are going to be. I think it's going to be a great starring role for a mid-50 Korean actress. There's a lot there. She's a real character. I think setting is going to be interesting. And then the food photography will be fantastic, right? Because there's these immaculate spreads and everything else. And there's some real plot. There's some real plotty kind of stuff that goes in as well. But I'm really glad we got a chance to talk about it. We got a chance to read it. It's the kind of book that I could read versions of it. You know, you could Mad Lib it a little bit. Like, you switch out food for baseball. You switch out food for baseball and cancer for ghosts, and you've got Field of Dreams. So there you go. You know, this spinning molten core of, I don't understand my parents don't understand me, and what are we going to do about it? I mean, it's like the Trojan War of emotion. There's stories to be told for all time about this sort of thing.
It's true. Yeah. I also just want to mention before we end up, I think she does some really wonderful writing about the tension of being a biracial person in America and balancing, in her experience and from her mom, the standards of beauty that she learned about on both sides. What did it mean to be a beautiful Korean person? What would it have meant to be perceived as white, even though she was only ever perceived as white when she wasn't in America? And she even has a moment with her mother where she says something like, you don't understand what it's like being the only Korean person at school. And her mom says, but you're not American. Korean, you're American. Yeah. And it's like, well, I'm both and you don't get it. But that tension, and that she never feels like she's wholly doing one thing because she is more than one thing, I think she writes about really, really beautifully. And yeah, I am very glad to have read it. I think I would have gotten to this one eventually, but it wasn't at the top of my urgency reading list. And I'm very glad that I got
also,
to
if you ever find yourself in proximity to an H Mart and haven't been, go. It's really cool. You learn something, see all kinds of interesting things, maybe pick up a new cuisine or two. But a wonderful institution, and I'm glad there's a bunch of them around there to see. All right, Rebecca, thanks. We'll talk to you next time.
Thank you.